twin suicide bombing hits a crowded market in the Iraqi capital, leaving at least 32 people dead and more than 100 others wounded. The UK says it will tighten its border restrictions as the country is grappling with a rising number of COVID-19 deaths and infections. The German Chancellor defends the decision to extend the country's strict lockdown until mid-February to slow a more aggressive variant of COVID-19. And welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Now let's take a look at Baghdad, the Iraqi capital. Two bomb explosions have rocked the center of the capital, leaving more than 30 people dead in the first such attack in years. The explosions ripped through a crowded market near Tehran Square in central Baghdad. Security sources saying that two attackers wearing explosive vests blew themselves up among shoppers. More than 110 people were also injured. No claim of responsibility. Suicide bombings have been rare in the Iraqi capital since the defeat of the Daesh terror group in 2017. Political analyst Ali Al-Neshmi says that the Daesh terror group is making a resurgence in Iraq thanks to U.S.-Israeli efforts to weaken the country's popular mobilization units.
There is many injured, more than 100, and the martyrs is more than 30. And no one declared till now about who's behind it. But I think there is many wings or many directions behind that, and especially now the ISILs increasing their action in the Iraq, especially in this period when the government and the Western and American and Israel, they targeted the popular mobilization and the people now shouting against them, and they listen for this media against the popular mobilization, and there is a policy now from 6 months to reducing or to weakening popular mobilization. Then they used that kind of weakening and they escaped and come in the central of Baghdad and using the explosive belt.
The UK saying that it will be tightening its border controls as the country is struggling to contain the new wave of the novel coronavirus. A spokesman for the Prime Minister says that Britain stands ready to strengthen its border policy following a surge in COVID-19 cases and deaths. Boris Johnson is set to impose further restrictions on the public by prohibiting international travel. The UK has seen a record number of COVID deaths, with authorities warning the numbers will rise further. The country reported 39,000 new cases on Wednesday, while its daily death toll has topped 1,500 over the past 3 days. Elsewhere in Europe, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has defended her government's decision to extend national lockdown restrictions until mid-February amid concerns over a new variant in Europe. Let's learn some more about the situation in the UK. So from London, I'm joined by Amina Taylor. Amina, good to have you with us, and hopefully you're safe from this virus. So since we talked to each other a few days ago, what's the situation like? Is it any better?
Well, when we actually spoke, we were talking about that record of some 1,600 reported death cases on Tuesday. And with that number jumping to 1,800, of course, there is going to be a stark public outcry for something to be done. And I'm afraid this was all very predictable. I mean, even when we were speaking to some of our experts back in November, when we had that partial second national lockdown, they were saying, quite frankly, it just was not stringent enough. You cast your mind back to the summer when we had that eat out to help out policy. And we cast our minds further back than that, when we were pretty much encouraged to go out and try and support the economy after the first lockdown wrapped in June. So we're now seeing a cumulative effect of a track and trace system that has failed, We're seeing the cumulative effect of government policy and notifications here that have been all over the place. And we've also been seeing the policy of the National Health Service that's been straining at the gills. So we're now in a position where, unfortunately, Boris Johnson and his government, they're putting their eggs in the vaccination basket in order to try and lift Britain out of this pandemic. Unfortunately, the country's leading the tables in some rather distressing news. And until there is a concerted effort here to just bite the bullet once and for all, have a proper lockdown, and then see where we are in a few weeks. Because at the moment, unfortunately, every new statistical release is more cause for concern from the public.
Okay, well, hope for better days to come. Thank you very much for that, Amina Taylor, who joined me from our London bureau in London. Now, anti-establishment protesters in the U.S. have clashed with police in the cities of Portland and Seattle. Police fired tear gas to disperse demonstrators. They smashed windows of local Democratic Party headquarters and also later targeted the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Facility. Anti-government protesters also took to the streets of Seattle, police saying that multiple sites were vandalized. Protesters rejected a U.S. election result and said there was widespread fraud in the November vote. U.S. President Joe Biden has signed 17 executive orders to undo Donald Trump's policies hours after taking office. The orders target the former president's policies on immigration, climate change, racial equity, and the handling of the coronavirus pandemic. The actions initiate the process of the U.S. rejoining the Paris Climate Accord and include the revocation of a presidential permit granted for a controversial oil pipeline. In another order, Biden ended a travel ban that Trump put in place on some Muslim-majority countries. The new president has also made compulsory wearing masks in all federal buildings and land. The president's move comes following his inaugural address in Washington, D.C.
Democrat Joe Biden has been inaugurated as president of the United States, replacing the highly controversial Donald Trump. As a result of entrenched but minority perceptions of electoral fraud, there was not a peaceful transfer of power. The nation's capital was locked down into a fortress with more soldiers than the U.S. uses to occupy both Afghanistan and Iraq. State capitals were similarly swarming with troops nationwide. The inauguration is being called a merciful conclusion to an electoral campaign which seemingly started the day after the election of Trump in 2016, and then the most divisive vote in recent memory. Biden's inaugural speech spoke often of unity and reconciliation, but Democrats and Republicans seem to have been at each other's throats for four consecutive years. How to turn off this mutual animosity may be the most urgent problem Biden faces, but it may also be the most difficult. Biden inherits an America which may be at its lowest point in history. America in 2020 combines 1930s economic depression, 1960s cultural division, 1860s concerns with white supremacy, and 1780s questions of political legitimacy. The coronavirus is killing Americans faster than ever. A highly divisive Senate trial of the recently impeached Trump looms. Gun sales and murder records were recently recorded nationwide, and the country remains on high alert for acts of political terrorism, to name a few of the worst problems. Both Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are considered to be on the right wing of the Democratic Party. Biden's cabinet is filled with holdovers from the era of Barack Obama, during which Biden was the vice president. Kamala Harris has become the highest-ranking woman ever in American history. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is urging the U.S. newly sworn-in president to start a new political path and correct the historical mistakes that Washington committed against the Palestinians.
We hope that the new U.S. administration headed by Joe Biden will start a new political path in the region and correct the historical mistakes it committed against our Palestinian people, its denial of our rights, and its standing by the occupation and covering up for it in order to continue denying our rights and aggression against our Palestinian people.
The Hamas spokesman also urged the U.S. to stop its efforts to force the countries in West Asia to normalize ties with the Tel Aviv regime. He was referring to the agreements between Israel and several Arab countries during Trump's presidency. Bahrain and the UAE signed a U.S.-sponsored normalization deals in September. That drew condemnation from the Muslim world, Palestinians calling it a stab in the back. Then we had Sudan and Morocco as the next Arab states that agreed to normalize ties with Israel, despite popular opposition at home. Now, Beijing is saying its sanctions against 28 former U.S. officials over alleged violations of China's sovereignty are justified and necessary.
Over the past few years, some anti-China politicians in the United States, out of their selfish political interests and prejudice and hatred against China, have planned, promoted, and executed the crazy moves which have gravely interfered in China's internal affairs, undermined China's interests, offended the Chinese people, and seriously damaged China-U.S. relations.
The Chinese foreign minister said that the reciprocal sanctions demonstrate Beijing's determination to safeguard its national interest. The measures ban allies of former President Donald Trump and their families from entering mainland China, Hong Kong, and the autonomous region of Macau. Companies associated with them are also banned from doing business with China. Those sanctions include former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and former National Security Advisor John Bolton. The Chinese foreign ministry says the blacklist includes anti-China politicians who've displayed hatred and selfish political interests and prejudice toward the country. The Iranian foreign minister is warning the new U.S. president of Israeli plots to push Washington into confrontation with the Islamic Republic. Mohammad Javad Zarif says that the Israeli prime minister aimed to trap another U.S. president into spending American blood and treasure to confront Iran. Zarif also lambasted Netanyahu's congratulatory message to Biden, in which he urged the newly sworn-in president to work with Israel to confront what he called the Iran threat. Zarif called the message bootlicking and cringeworthy obsequiousness, stressing such desperate plotting against Iran will fail. Israel's call for an anti-Iran stance follows Biden's remarks about a conditional return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Now, Abu Dhabi has reportedly secured a deal for the purchase of dozens of advanced F-35 fighter jets from the United States, and that shortly before former President Donald Trump's term came to an end. My colleague has discussed that issue with our guests in the News Review program.
On this news review, the United Arab Emirates has reportedly signed a deal with the U.S. for 50 F-35 fighter jets despite concerns about the Arab country's involvement in a deadly and devastating war on Yemen. Reports said the agreement was signed to about an hour before President Joe Biden was sworn into office. The UAE also signed a separate agreement to buy up to 18 armed drones. However, the new U.S. president has said he will re-examine the agreement. The administration of former President Donald Trump had approved $23 billion in stealth-capable F-35 jets, Reaper drones, and other weapons to its Persian Gulf ally after it agreed to recognize Israel. The UAE is a member of the Saudi-led coalition that has been engaged in the years-long war on Yemen, which faces the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have political analyst Mohammed Obey joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also, we have historian and journalist Brecht Yonkers joining us from Hangzhou. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Obey in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mr. Obey, what do you have to say about this deal and also about the timing of when it was signed?
Well, first of all, the timing indicates that there will be some changes, although one should not be exaggerating. As for the era of Trump versus the era of Biden, but the rushing to sign the agreement a few hours before the inauguration of Biden indicates that there will be some complications regarding those people who were regarded as the favorite allies of the former President Trump. I mean by this the Gulf state countries, that rushed also to normalize with the Israelis in order to gain the pleasing the U.S. administration. So this is on the one hand. On the other, also, we can understand that the course of the American support of the huge, atrocious genocide that's taking place in Yemen will not be business as usual, as was the case with the former administration. And this is not due to the fact that the new administration is rather better or something, but the issue with the Trump administration and himself personally was that he cared nothing about whatever the whole world would say about this. The issue with this administration is that we will have the usual hypocrisy of the American administrations, that we are for human rights, that we are for not hitting civilians, etc., etc. But at the same time, they will be backing the Saudi aggression against Yemen, but without declaring this in public and without selling arms in public, etc.
Mr. Yonkers, what do you think about the timing? Mr. Bates says there will be some changes between U.S. administrations, but not too much to expect.
Yeah, I think that there is a combination of factors at play here. I mean, number one, of course, being that Donald Trump has always been a very vocal supporter of the, you know, the U.S.-backed satellite states, let's call them, in the Persian Gulf, in the wider region of the Middle East. And most importantly, of course, he has been an avid supporter of Saudi Arabia to an extent that has never been openly seen before in any U.S. administration before. Indeed, as the other guest pointed out very, very correctly, Donald Trump didn't really care much about how it would be perceived. He was willing to play openly dirty in order to make sure that that nobody would even dare to examine, you know, the dirty politics of Mohammed bin Salman and Mohammed bin Zayed in the UAE. But the second part, I think, that is on at play here is it's not just, of course, the United States selling more modern weaponry to the UAE. That by itself is not necessarily surprising, especially since Abu Dhabi just recognized the Zionist entity not so long ago and was expecting some sort of reward for this. But secondly, why did they do it an hour before the official inauguration? This, just like many other things that were done by Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo in the last week, for a big part also has, I believe, a domestic value to it. This is basically a bully tactic in order to put more pressure on Joe Biden and make his work more difficult. This is the same thing and the same reason why Donald Trump and Mike Pompeo have decided to allow U.S. politicians to have official contacts with the breakaway state of Taiwan, which is, according to, you know, some reactionaries, considered to be an independent country, but in reality, by most of the world, is considered to be a rogue province of China, of course. This is also the same reason why they decided to designate Ansarullah in Yemen as a quote-unquote terrorist organization and are basically blocking all humanitarian aid soon from the United States or any other nation that wants to deal with the United States to help food provisions towards Yemen, because sending food to Yemen can be considered helping a terrorist organization now. These things, for a major part, I believe, are done just to make the work for the Democrats harder, just to make it harder for the Biden presidency to do even the slightest bit of good if they wanted to do so.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Historian and journalist Brecht Yonkers joining us from Hasselt. Also thanks to political analyst Mohammed Obaid speaking to us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. But do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here. Bye for now.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kHz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kHz, and in southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
President Trump authorized the declassification of documents relating to the FBI's Russia investigation, the inquiry that clouded his first years in office and that he has sought retribution for ever since. The release of the documents on the eve of his departure appears to be the final attempt by Donald Trump whilst in office to settle scores with the FBI and to undermine the investigation known as Crossfire Hurricane. Mr. Trump and his allies have long attacked the officials who opened the inquiry as politically motivated. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Adam Goldman. The piece is titled, Trump Approves Document Disclosures in Apparent Bid to Taint Russia Investigation. Stay with us for more of Adam Goldman's article. President Donald Trump has authorized the declassification of documents relating to the FBI's Russia investigation, the inquiry that clouded his first years in office and that he has sought retribution for ever since. The release of the documents on the eve of his departure appears to be the final attempt by Mr. Trump while in office to settle scores with the FBI and to undermine the investigation known as Crossfire Hurricane. Donald Trump and his allies have long attacked the officials in FBI who opened the inquiry as politically motivated. No documents were immediately released, and it was not clear what material Donald Trump declassified or why he waited until the final hours of his presidency to do so. He said there was a binder with materials on the investigation. I determined that the materials in that binder should be declassified to the maximum extent possible, Donald Trump wrote in a memo to the Attorney General and the Directors of National Intelligence and the CIA that was released by the White House. He had accepted some redactions. The White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows had also long attacked the investigation and pressed for the release of more information and documents whilst in his previous role as a congressman. While Mark Meadows served as Donald Trump's top aide, the White House repeatedly declassified documents in an apparent effort to taint Crossfire Hurricane, drawing condemnations that the administration was politicizing intelligence. Career intelligence officials objected to the move, concerned that it would jeopardize intelligence gathering and sources of information. The review by the Justice Department's Independent Inspector General determined that investigators had sufficient reason to open the Russia inquiry and found no evidence that political bias played a role in the move. Meanwhile, President Trump delivered a defiant and unapologetic farewell speech to the nation in a video released on Tuesday, 19th of January, declaring that he took on the toughest battles and vowing that the movement we started is only just beginning. Donald Trump, who has not appeared in public in days and remained in seclusion at the White House in his final hours in office, sought to frame his administration as a period of progress, despite the coronavirus pandemic that has now killed 400,000 Americans and the divisions that led to the storming of the Capitol building this month by a mob of his supporters. "I did not seek the easiest course of action," Donald Trump said in the 20-minute video posted online the day before he leaves office. "By far, it was actually the most difficult. I did not seek the path that would get the least criticism. I took on the tough battles, the hardest fights, the most difficult choices, because that's what you elected me to do. Your needs were my first and last unyielding focus. This, I hope, will be our greatest legacy." Trump made no explicit concession to President-elect Joseph R. Biden Jr., nor did he mention his name. After months of falsely claiming that he did not lose the election and trying to overturn the results of the election, Donald Trump has scorned the traditional transition of power, refusing to invite Joe Biden for the customary post-election visit to the White House and opting to skip the inaugural ceremony on Wednesday, 20th of January. In his farewell speech, Donald Trump also condemned the 6th of January attack on the Capitol building without acknowledging any responsibility for encouraging his supporters to take such action, for which he has been impeached by the House and faces trial by the U.S. Senate. "All Americans were horrified by the assault on our Capitol," he said. "Political violence is an attack on everything we cherish as Americans. It can never be tolerated." Likewise, as the death toll from the coronavirus pandemic reached a macabre new benchmark, Trump offered no regrets about his handling of the virus, which he repeatedly dismissed and said would simply disappear. He claimed credit for the record-fast development of vaccines, though, which even some opponents have praised him for, but made no mention of the troubles that have slowed the distribution of the vaccines.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Whose Streets, directed by Saba Folayan and Damon Davis. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, Whose Streets is an unflinching look at the Ferguson uprising in the US state of Missouri. The uprising sparked nationwide protests the day after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. Now, filmed on the front line of the clashes, this documentary captures the explosions, the tear gas, and the military-style police vehicles up close. And at the same time, the film also manages to show the anger and sense of outrage that the heavy-handed response provoked.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county line, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
Ferguson police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
People flooded in the area have some experience with police.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars, right here in canine units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you hear about.
This movement was born in love.
We are raising activists. If there's going to be any change, it starts with our children.
This is going to be my fighter right here. Come here.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary provides a really great insight into the racial tensions of the black community in Ferguson and the police and the issue of police brutality is brought up. And we also get incredible access of the residents themselves who express their struggle from their point of view. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Whose Streets?
The film is very specifically about Ferguson. It's not a general film about policing in America or Black Lives Matter or any of the bigger issues. It's very, very specifically about Ferguson. It does obviously touch on much bigger issues as a result. So it feels like a really important document, but it's not as easy to watch as a film. It doesn't have a central narrative line. It has a lot of great characters in it, people that it explores. Mm-hmm. But the thing that makes it really, really worth watching is the footage in it. It's full of incredibly shot
footage on people's phones and their own private cameras right on the streets in the middle of all of these riots and all of the tensions and the back and forth of everything going on. So it's showing us a side of the story that the media never showed, because the media kind of took a very slanted view of this whole thing. And
the documentary highlights this.
The documentary contrasts the footage that was shot in the streets with what the media showed the public, and that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes the film definitely worth seeing.
So as Richard was saying, it is an incredibly big topic with lots of layers, especially on the issue of racism, police brutality, and American gun violence, and so forth. Leek, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on these sorts of films, and why are they important?
I think it's an important part of documentation of the struggle of ordinary communities against excessive police violence and institutionalized racism, and that part, you know, it forms an essential documentary narrative around detailing their particular stories from a human perspective. Each individual family is looked at and goes into some detail. So it really gives you the full 3D picture of what a community under pressure from police racism and violence looks like, feels like, smells like, how they respond personally, how it affects their personal lives and the communities around them. And for that, I think it's an important part of social documentary.
But as Rich was saying, this documentary largely focuses on Ferguson. Mm. But as we know, the African American community have been plagued by police brutality for decades. Mm. But what is it that made the Ferguson uprising so different?
I think it's a combination of things, really. I think that by the time 2014 comes along and the impact on new technology, on people's understanding of justice and struggle, and the extent to which we now see people capturing inappropriate policing incidents on their own mobile phones, gives this a unique feel because it's from 1,001 different perspectives. If anything, this film is almost like a people's film made up of huge numbers of individual filmmakers who captured various scenes, and they've tried to knit it together in the way that has been described. So I think new technology, I think Hands Up, Don't Shoot, and the Black Lives Matter are all emanated from it. I think people were tired of an Obama rhetoric which was about equality but seemed very little in terms of holding police to be accountable at a local level. And the images themselves were so deeply resonant of the black experience and the African-American experience in the United States as to sort of re-excite an embryonic civil rights movement. The scenes we saw on black and white and color pictures of police brutality and victims in Ferguson in 2014 could have been Ferguson 1964. Yeah. And that was the power of their message.
And the power of relevance today, exactly. Yeah. Rich, so one observer in the documentary calls the clash between the police and the black community a, quote, unseen war. And it's been reported that $11 million was reportedly spent on law enforcement connected to the Ferguson uprising. Do you think the film is successful in showing how aggressive the policing is?
I think it really does. I mean, on the one side, it shows how these people just come to the streets just saying, how can you shoot an unarmed teenager 10 times? How can the police do this and then try to pretend like it's not an issue? And then the police respond to them coming out into the streets with, I mean, what you saw in the clip was, they're all standing in a line looking really menacing. But later on, they come out with full riot gear and dogs and, you know, snipers on the tops of these giant tanks that are rolling into the streets. It's pretty terrifying because the police just reacted as if the public, who are just desperately crying out saying, don't treat us like this. The police are reacting as if they're the villains. The general public are the villains. And the film really captures that sense that these people just feel desperate and they don't really have a choice but to riot. Mm-hmm. They start off with a quiet vigil. It's a candlelight vigil. And their voices get louder and louder and louder because nobody's listening to them. And the police are responding like that.
As it said in the film also that Martin Luther King is quoted as saying, the riots is the way, an act of showing the protest of the unheard. Now, Lee, what do you think of the militarization of the police? Is this an appropriate response to deal with the situation?
Well, it's not in a liberal democracy in supposedly, the land of the free. I think what we're seeing all over the world, really, in Western democracies, is increasing militarization. And in fact, most Western police services are almost following a sort of Israeli policing model. That seems to be the standard model, to be very heavily militarized, and to have the option of using overwhelming and overpowering force. The policing that we saw in Ferguson was akin to an invasion by a small army of a foreign occupying force seeking to invade another country. The combatants' language was the same, the imagery was the same, and I think it's a very dangerous precedent when the police force, and that's what it is, a force, can militarize itself using the advanced latest equipment available to them of any military in the world for use against civilians.
And it's exactly the point that you raised that actually, because in the film we see an American Palestinian resident of Ferguson, and he used to live in the West Bank, and he said it's no different, the West Bank and Ferguson, in the way they're being treated. Do you think that's a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. I think if you look at the administration and dispensation of justice on the West Bank, Gaza, and you begin to look at Ferguson and other areas of the United States, you can see that an apartheid level of justice is being dispensed both in West Bank and in America. And to that extent, Israel and America share a similar approach to tackling minority groups that they dislike intensely, and that is to oppress and police them out of oblivion, really.
I want to talk quickly just how the police are portrayed in this documentary. We see the police officers wearing, some of them wearing bracelets for support for Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. What did you make of this?
Well, I like the fact that they let them speak. It's not a purely one-sided documentary. It does kind of let people speak. But then the things the police said in reaction to this event and to the escalating violence were just all wrong. You know, they vilified Mike Brown. They showed, you know, a clip of him stealing something from a shop to say, oh, he was a hardened criminal. Well, it still doesn't mean that you can shoot him 10 times when he's unarmed in the back. I mean, that's crazy. The way that they spun the story and all of their press conferences and even the comments that they make to the cameras.
But they play the victim.
They play the victim. Themselves. And they act like they're the ones who are being attacked. And it's quite frightening, actually.
Sorry, Lee, you wanted to quickly add something?
I think what it also hints to is the vast chasm of perceptions between sections of white America and sections of black America about the nature, scale of racism. And what it means. And I think there's a conversation there that is being conducted through megaphones around a awfully complex and nuanced issue that is reflected in the total lack of understanding, I think, from white America about the reality of racism as it affects African Americans, Latinos, African Muslims, and so on and so forth in the USA. And
I don't think it's all of white America. I think there's a segment of white America that is just ignorant of the whole thing. There's quite a large segment that is aware of what's going on and is fighting.
I think I would agree with you, but I would say that racial inequality.
We did see a lot of white people in the crowds in support of the black.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and I think that's right. But I think that when you look at it over the course of history, that what you find is, despite whites having some theoretical acknowledgement of the existence of racism, racial inequality in America and the UK has gotten worse over every single measure. And so a rhetorical understanding of racism and a practical and a theoretical understanding that gives you the tools to deal with it are two separate things.
Okay, great points there. We'll continue this, just taking a break now.
This was actually the first camera that I got when I first started cop watching. I just put my stickers on it, you know, put a picture on my camera so when the police looking, they could see that cop watch stick on there. Got some walkie-talkies. This is two of them for me. So when I leave, I get one to my wife. So the cops don't come in Canfield, like, no more, like, doing none of that crap. They do stranger stuff. And that's because we done changed. We made them change what they doing. That's all I want. You know, don't give them an opportunity to gun somebody down in the street. Be out there to watch them. I don't go out with no weapons or nothing like that. I go out with my camera. That's my weapon, you know. And the fact is that since the police are not being held accountable, we have to hold them accountable.
You saw David there with the Cop Watch Initiative. It's quite an endearing and inspirational character. Rich, what did you make of his story and progression?
I enjoyed his story. I like the fact that he's taking a positive approach to it. He's doing something that's really important, and the footage he's capturing is invaluable in making sure that everyone understands what's really going on.
And Lee, what do you make of these sorts of initiatives? Do you think social media helps in the struggle for racial justice?
Incredibly. I think they've made a huge difference, actually, to the optics and the understanding of the reality of racism. And of course, what we saw as a consequence of that type of activism is years later, you know, in-depth studies that showed the Ferguson police force were operating a sort of income-driven arrest policy that targeted poor blacks, and they were almost financially incentivized to racially profile that community. And I think that the cameras and the people and social media and access to it allows our community to get its voice heard.
And Rich, we also see, speaking of cameras actually, we see the coverage of how the hostility of the black community to the mainstream media in this documentary. Yeah. Why do you think they were so hostile as
portrayed? Well, because the mainstream media covered this as an incident of looting. You know, they didn't cover it as a policeman killed an unarmed teenager. They covered it as, you know, residents of Ferguson are looting their local shops. They covered the wrong story.
And Lee, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. What do you think of the mainstream media coverage of sort of these movements, Black Lives Matter and police brutality?
I think we saw the same at the Grenfell Tower fire disaster post there, where the mainstream media descended on a community and they were very hostile to them. And I think it's largely because there are so few black and ethnic minority peoples in British newsrooms and US newsrooms. And even where they are there, the narrative seems to be overwhelmingly one of a sort of establishment elite perspective. New technology and these films give us an absolute way of breaking through that monitorium of silence that we've had for so long and allows these fresh voices for justice to percolate into the public consciousness. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time, and the internet may well be the thing that holds policing to account to a greater extent than anything else we've ever done.
So there's hope in the battle ahead then. That's great. So we're just going to take
as long as
a brief break now from a discussion.
Good evening. My name is Bernie Frazier, and like all of you all, I'm a Ferguson resident. There are a lot of people in Ferguson who have become very fearful of living in this community. But I would like to help you understand one thing. There are many people who have only been fearful for 2 months. There are more people who have been fearful for 2 decades.
Must have been very awkward for the black police officer to be in that situation, probably feeling very conflicted. I just want to read a statistic about US deaths by police gunfire, and by the Washington Post it reported that at least 1,000 people were killed in 2017, and it's on track to reach that level. Lee, why do you think the issue of police brutality is such a big problem in the US?
I think it's largely because of the failure of US justice system to deliver equitable justice for people who suffered from grievous police assault and brutality. There's been systematic cover-up of those sorts of abuses. We've seen that year after year. 1,000 people dying in 2017, those are the numbers you expect in a small war, somewhere very distant. And it shows the extent to which the process of Jim Crow policing, and that's what it is, it's a Jim Crow-style policing without all of the formality of policy and legislation, but producing equally iniquitous outcomes, is the reality for most black experiences in America. Two-tier justice, apartheid levels of administration of justice, and a gross denial of the reality of racism that just angers and inflames disadvantaged communities.
And in the documentary, we see various references to President Obama at the time, and we get the sense of the frustration that the residents were powerless, even with a black president, so that they couldn't get their justice. What did you make of this?
Well, I mean, they say he's not a black president, which is very telling. It's a very telling thing for them to say, because they feel like he's not sticking up for them. I'm not sure how much power he has to intervene in a local clash like that. And he did initiate an investigation into it, which did result in the finding that that police force was systemically racist. Mm-hmm. But then every investigation into every police force in America has come up with that same in every city all over the entire country, from Los Angeles to, you know, I mean, everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's a problem in the entire nation. And I think you know, like you were saying, it's a nation that's never really dealt with slavery.
Absolutely.
They made it illegal 150 years ago, and then they never really got rid of it.
That's right.
And they've just changed it into a system of, you know, oppressive policing and marginalization and it's that system that's carried on, and people are just now saying we're not going to put up with this anymore.
And then fast forward to today's president, we have Donald Trump, who has been criticized for encouraging police brutality, saying that the police are being too nice. What do you think of Trump's role, Lee, in race relations and police brutality?
Well, Trump is the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant white privileged man in chief. He uses the bully boy pulpit in Charlottesville. He backed the fascists. He seemed completely unapologetic for the murder of an anti-fascist demonstrator by fascists in that area. He subsequently made his views known in relation to Muslims and African Americans. I mean, there can be no doubt. There are lots of people saying, oh, well, maybe Donald will mature with age or somehow become more nuanced by the politics of Washington. He's become more extreme, more discriminatory, and in fact encapsulates the very worst aspects of a sort of white supremacist, male, bigoted patriarchy that has somehow, through the dint of wealth and corruption, found its way to the top job in the United States. It's a disgrace for the country. It's a threat to the world. And it is emboldening and enlivening fascists and racists all over the world. So when Donald comes to the United Kingdom, I expect the whole of the European alt-right to turn out to counter any demonstrations we much put out. That's how dangerous this man is in the world.
I'm afraid we'll have to end on that powerful note, Lee. Thank you to both my guests and to you. Don't forget to leave your comments and your thoughts. I've been Camille Shambiati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.